Welcome to the American Reformer Podcast, hosted by Josh Abatoy and Timon Klein. Our mission is to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day, rooted in the rich tradition of Protestant social and political thought.
Welcome back to the American Reformer Podcast. You've got Josh Abatoy, Executive Director. I am joined as always, or as usually, by Timon Klein, Editor-in-Chief. And we've got a special guest for you today, John Davidson. John is a senior editor at The Federalist, among many other things. And he has a book in the works that we're here to talk about. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we always do this with our guests. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background professionally and what you work on and what's brought you to now writing this book.
Sure. Yeah. Like you said, I'm a senior editor at The Federalist. My background is in journalism. It's really the only job I've had since college, which was, I hesitate to say how many years ago, but a couple decades now. I have been a journalist all over the country in just about every format you can imagine. I graduated from college in 2004, just as journalism was collapsing. So I'm one of those people that actually worked at a print, paper when it would like go to the press at midnight every day, which makes me something of a dinosaur, right, compared to my younger colleagues. But I joined The Federalist in March of 2016 to cover the 2016 election cycle and have been there ever since, writing mostly about politics, but also about culture and religion and the intersection of the three. And that sort of led me to write this book, which is called Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity in the Dark Age to Come. And the genesis of the book was sort of happenstance and accidental. 2 years ago, I went and saw this movie that some of you may have seen called The Northman. And it's about it's a Viking revenge epic set in pre-Christian Scandinavia. And it gives this picture, this really like gritty, realistic, raw picture of the pagan world of Northern Europe. And it really struck me watching this video how brutal the pagan world was and how many of the pagan practices in Northern Europe were brought to an end, not by anything other than that world's encounter with Christianity in the 10th century, 10th and 11th century. And I wrote a review of it. And a couple months later, I got an email from an editor at Regnery Press saying, hey, do you want to write a book about this and about what it means that we are entering a post-Christian age and, what the implications are of that. And I could hardly believe someone was asking me to write a book about this, but I said, yes, I would love to write a book about that. So that's what the book is about. It's about what happens to America and what happens to the West as we shed the Christianity that created us and that created our civilization and what the future is going to bring.
Well, if I can hop in there, Josh, on that, I mean, I think one thing kind of taking it from the top, and this is very on brand for us, is if there is a if there's a shift towards something else from Christianity, by implication, you're including some kind of claim about what America was and has been, and maybe the West generally. So, I mean, how do you, that alone may be contestable for many people. A lot of people don't like that, especially any kind of Christian nation thesis about America's early beginnings and founding. And we might even juxtapose both the Eggers films of The Witch, about a still very spiritualized world, but of the Puritans in early New England with the Northmen, right? These two very different worlds. So with that kind of in the background, it's something's receding and there's some kind of transition. What are, how do you approach those questions about what maybe we're losing or transitioning out of? What's it been like before?
Yeah, I take as my jumping off point and sort of the premise of a lot of my argument that America was founded as a Christian nation. That is to say, it wasn't founded as a theocracy, but it was the sort of society that the founders understood and said many times is only going to be possible with a predominantly Christian people that accept the moral and sort of cosmological claims of the Christian faith. And I go into that in some detail in the second chapter to sort of lay the groundwork for the rest of the argument. And my argument, and, you know, again, this isn't something I've come up with. The whole book isn't really something I've come up with. I just feel like I'm connecting some dots for people who may not fully realize what's happening or why. But my premise is that you can't have a Republican self-government without a predominantly Christian people that accept the claims of Christianity about human nature, the human person, our relationship to one another, and our relationship to God. And things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, consent of the governed, rule by law and not by force. These are all things that come out of Christianity. And they don't just come out of Christianity sort of like, you know, and subsist on their own, but they require for their vitality and for their potency a Christianity active among the people themselves. And so if you have that kind of society, then you can have Republican self-government. And the tolerance, even the religious tolerance for non-Christian people of non-Christian faiths or no faiths, is a luxury good that only a Christian society can afford. And once you lose the faith and lose the religious character among the people, you are going to lose the forms of government and the form of society that go with it. And you cannot sustain the one without the other.
Yeah. I often say that, toleration, which I think is the proper way to think about what at least we initially how we thought of these relationships in society. Mm-hmm. Tolerance is impossible in, say, a pagan is often described Rome with the multiplicity of deities. It doesn't have it. It's incoherent when already that paganism's nature, it's like key characteristic is the fact that everything is within certain parameters accepted. There's no place for any kind of conception of toleration. That doesn't make any sense if there's not a predominant deity and religious ethos around that, and some of those, like you said, I mean, cosmological and even eschatological claims of Christianity being foundational in our system. I mean, that's why you had for a long time, sort of religious tests for office that were, pretty bare bones. If you're a theologian, it's not really a qualification for the ministry, but you one of the main ones would be that you have to believe in some kind of judgment in the afterlife, right? Mm-hmm. Judgment before God, you have to believe in that there is a God and so on and so forth. So these are all Christian assumptions as the basis for any kind of civil society. But I plugged there already talking about paganism. I think the other thing to get on the table, if we've defined where we're coming from with America, is how you think about the definition and the characteristics of paganism as being the thing that's now encroaching upon a Christian nation.
Yeah. When we talk about paganism, and when I talk about it in the book, I don't mean that we are going to see a sudden resurgence of, worship of Zeus or Apollo or Odin, or a sudden explosion of witchcraft. Although those things are on the rise, that's not primarily what I mean. The paganism that's emerging now in the modern or postmodern world is going to look outwardly different than ancient paganism, but it will be no less pagan for all that. And by that, I mean it will adhere to and propagate, the pagan ethos, which could be simply summarized as nothing is true, everything is permitted. And the pagan ethos kind of posits a world without transcendent moral truths, and it freed up in the ancient times the pagans to assign divine status to things or even to people or to natural phenomenon, and to sort of divinize the here and now and reject the overarching universal transcendent. And that's one of the main things that distinguishes it from a sort of a Christian cosmological worldview, right? As Christians, we say that there is a universal moral truth that applies to all people in all places, and that there are certain behaviors and ways of treating one another and organizing society that are incumbent upon us. If we accept that, if we accept the Christian teaching, for example, of Imago Dei, that everyone's created in the image and likeness of God, that confers a certain, you know, dignity and rights on people. You can't do to people whatever you want. You cannot discard the infant. You cannot slaughter the slave. And it imposes a kind of restraint on the exercise of power and will and coercion. So when I say that we are entering into a pagan epoch and coming out of a Christian epoch, and that we're actually living in a post-Christian society, I mean that we have adopted a pagan ethos that nothing is true and everything is permitted, and that force and coercion and will are going to determine what is right rather than any kind of universal moral claims about human nature and our relationship to one another and our relationship to God. And that's the key distinction between a Christian world and a pagan world. And it's one of the reasons that the only thing that ever brought an end to the pagan world was its encounter with Christianity and its encounter with these claims about the human person and about God.
Now, Josh, I'm sure you're going to want to hop in there because we were discussing some of these definitional elements before we started recording.
Yeah.
So feel free to hop in there with the this question of what paganism looked like.
Well, I'll get a little bit Socratic here. I mean, there's a line of thinking about what's going on in our world today that would say that what we're dealing with, like the primary emerging orthodoxy, public conception of morality, it is sort of a derivative of communism or Marxism, right? Like it's this dialectic materialism that under Karl Marx's hand, it had to do with the struggle between capital and labor. And then in the 20th century, through theorists like Gramsci and all the rest, it transmogrifies into a struggle between the privileged and the oppressed. But, you know, this is still, it's still sort of fundamentally operating within a materialist universe. And so it's determined, it depends upon a type of deterministic materialism. And so, you know, I guess I'd love to hear your interaction with that idea. Like we all know wokeness and CRT, these popular expressions of this deep idea, are very regnant. But do you find them to be a species of paganism, or is that something different that will actually be displaced by an emerging paganism?
I think in one sense they are pagan, and in another sense they're Christian, right? Some of the claims, the rhetoric remains largely Christian in the sense that it invokes Christian ideals and principles like dignity, human rights, you know, even debates about, like, you know, transgenderism, right? That we have to recognize the dignity and the rights of transgender people. They're invoking Christian principles there, but they're doing it for sort of in service of pagan ends, because they don't really believe in human rights, and they don't really believe in human dignity, and they don't believe in sort of the givenness of human nature, which is what Christians would say confers our dignity upon us, that we are given a nature that is in the image and likeness of God, and that's why we have dignity, and that's why we have rights, because we're God's creatures, and we are meant for union and communion with God, right? So to back up a little bit, I think that a lot of the discussion and the debate and the historical reality of communism was something that was happening kind of within the Western Christian tradition, and was premised on Christian assumptions about dignity and rights and whatnot. But in practice, it was pretty brutal and didn't really care about human rights or human dignity, and operated on the basis of power and coercion, much like the pagan empires of the pre-Christian world did. All of them did, across vast expanses of time and geography and cultures. So what we're seeing now is, I think it's mixed. Like I said, we're still kind of like borrowing the vocabulary of Christendom, but the reality is that we're discarding the underlying substance of the Christian claims about the universe and adopting pagan claims about what is true and who decides what is true and how it's decided. And those claims are being adjudicated increasingly not based on principles about universal, like, truth or claims about universal truths, but on power dynamics and coercion. And this is playing, you know, there's a million ways that we can see this playing out in our own time, but I think we get maybe tripped up thinking that because the rhetoric of Christianity is still being deployed, that there's real Christian substance behind it. And one of the things that I'm arguing in this book is that there's not, there's been a paradigm shift, and what we're seeing emerge is not a new iteration of the Christian ethos, but a revival of a pagan ethos.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the one way we could say it's at least circumstantial evidence of your thesis there is of course, you know, the very Marxian liberation theology, which is kind of borrowing from both. This is in many ways acted as a gateway drug in America, you know, in the 60s for a lot of the even more radical ideas. But there it is, borrowing all the structure and trappings of particularly Catholic theology, but then, you know, Protestants use it as well. And, but you know, smuggling in, we might say, different conceptions of both anthropology and, social relations and all sorts of things. So I think mm-hmm. It's certainly plausible. Other narratives of how it works might be plausible as well. But the wokeness issue is kind of one. You know, it captures a lot of attention right now, rightly so. It's one very big expression of sickness in our society. But is this, you know, I imagine this is not the only thing you focus on as evidence for your own thesis in America or in the West generally at present. So are there other kind of indicators of, you know, rising sort of paganism in the conception that you've already laid out?
Sure. One of the things I think that we are kind of conditioned to accept as Christians, and even, you know, even if you're not a Christian, but just you have come up in a Christian society, you expect that there to be a certain like coherence to things, you know, that ideas and systems of thought would cohere and be rational in some sense, or be reasonable, and be seen as reasonable by the average person. That's not a feature of paganism. There's a kind of disfigurement of reason that accompanies pagan systems of thought. And I think that we can see this emerging in our time when you see the kind of admixture of the invocation of the scientific and the rational together with the invocation of the radical, a radical subjectiveness, right? The idea that a man can become a woman by proclaiming that he feels as though he is a woman is one example of this. There's nothing rational or scientific about it. In other words, science and reason, sort of like prohibit this from being a possible conclusion that a person could come to. And so you're not operating in the realm of rational thought or scientific thought when you're proclaiming trans ideology. You're operating in a different realm of thought in which will and desire determine reality. And my argument is that is an example of the pagan ethos and the pagan worldview at work. You know, another example to get away from wokeness, right? Which I don't really talk about at length in the book, but to use maybe a more familiar culture war issue like abortion, we see how the justification for abortion has changed over time. It began as an argument that was supposedly based on science and rationality. This is just a clump of cells. It's not a human life. It's no different than an appendectomy. And, you know, it's just sort of Christian superstition to suppose that this is a human being whose life is being snuffed out. Well, not long after Roe versus Wade, medical technology advanced so quickly that that justification had to be discarded. And you saw this reflected in sort of the public rhetoric and debate about abortion in the 80s and 90s. And the new justification became, well, it just needs to be safe, legal, and rare. Okay. We sort of accept that this is an unfortunate thing, but, you know, women have rights and we can't take them away. And so let's just not talk about it too much and look too deeply into it. Medical advances being what they are, and sort of some of the images of in utero development being as arresting as they were during this time, we're just going to say it should be safe, legal, and rare and leave it at that. Well, we're way past that now. I don't know if y'all remember back in 2015, the viral Shout Your Abortion movement began. And that was the first time that we saw a defense of abortion as a positive good that was necessary for women to sort of reach their full actualization and actually be liberated, that the ability to kill the unborn was a precondition for the full rights and humanity of women to be actualized. This is a very different argument than the argument that started, because now what determines the difference between a unborn child that deserves protection under the law and medical care in cases of premature delivery and a unborn child who has no rights and protections and can be killed with impunity is only the desire of the mother to have or not have that child. It's not based on anything else. And the power dynamic there is what determines whether a child lives or dies. And that, I argue, is another example of the pagan ethos in operation, because it's based solely on power and solely of the exercise of power by the powerful against those without power, the weak and defenseless. And this is being championed openly and proclaimed as the justification for why abortion should remain legal in the United States, such that we have totally irrational laws in this country now, that an unborn child of a certain gestational age can be born in one state, and by law, all technology and efforts have to be made to save that child's life, and a child of the same age can be dismembered and killed in the womb in another state. It makes no sense rationally, but that's where we are.
Yeah, and I think something you're highlighting there too, that it's probably most chilling, even to people I've found that are still, pro-abortion in sort of the older sense, right? It's simply, we have a lot of liberals now that they don't, it's logically inconsistent based on their own precepts, but they think things have gone too far, right? They kind of wanted it to stay in the 90s, right? Like that was the nirvana. And so now you see some of them even disturbed by the expression that you're talking about, which is sort of sacramentizing the act of abortion, and it's got a very religious spiritual element. And I think that what is appropriate in calling this a sort of pagan expression is it's featuring all the aspects you're talking about in describing paganism, but also does, you know, the pagans of course did still have religious ceremonies and trappings. I mean, we think that they're false, but to them, they're very real. I mean, I don't know if you ever seen the movie or the History Channel show Vikings when it was out, as you were talking about the Northmen earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great show because it presents both the Christians and the pagans as they clash, as all the spiritual things they believe in as just being real. And so it's a war between mm-hmm. the gods, right? And Christ ends up triumphing over theirs at the end. And they kind of know this is happening to them. Right. They see it. And so they believe that the Christian God is real, but it's something to be fought. And there's a sense in which the way the left expresses itself around these sacred things, to the things that are sacred to them now, the gender stuff, the abortion stuff, it's like they do know that there's a force out there that's combating them, and they're recognizing the spiritual war, and they're kind of fighting it on those terms now. Yes. Whereas the left of 20 or 30 years ago, which were much more of, you know, the Richard Dawkins types and like pure materialist in a sort of defiant mode, although we could talk about his recent comments too, but the, sure. That's gone now. Everyone kind of realizes that there's something deeper, and that's why it's even nastier and more aggressive in a certain sense. Does that make sense where I'm going with that? I think it's a fascinating
Absolutely.
Element.
Absolutely. And I think that that older way of talking about it and thinking about it, that, you know, we could just stay kind of in this 1990s moment or this mid-century moment where the justifications for these things, you know, can just be left and we don't have to like play it out to its logical conclusion. That was a sort of a brief window or a brief caesura in the development and I would say, I guess, the decline of Christianity in the West, where they could sort of posit these things and it could just be secular and it could just be atheistic, and you could just kind of say, well, you know, this is what we need for women to kind of be equal. You know, they have to be allowed to do this, and we're not going to really probe the underlying, you know, philosophical claims that are being made. But that was never going to last, right? I think this whole idea that the end of Christianity, or not the end, but the, you know, the end of Christianity as a force in public life, as a basis for a polity, means that we're going to have this secular liberal utopia, is totally wrong. And that's one of the things that I am attacking in the book. We're not, the end of the Christian era is not going to bring in secular liberalism. Secular liberalism itself is a luxury good that was only possible in a Christian society. What we're going to have as Christianity declines is a return to some sort of religious contest, a contest between two competing visions of the world, both of which make spiritual, moral claims about what the world is and how it should be organized. And secularism, like atheistic Richard Dawkins style secular atheism, is not going to be a player. It's already not a player. Like, we're done with it. People are not even trying to defend transgenderism and abortion on the basis of that anymore. And it's one of the purposes of the book to explain how that works and why it is that we need to anticipate something else coming with the decline of Christianity.
There's so much to pull at there. You know, as you were talking, I mean, I guess another, you know, again, Socratically interrogating the thesis a little bit, but one of the distinctions between a new paganism and old paganism to me is the, I see in it a different relation to nature. So, you know, nature in the old paganism is powerful. It's beyond the scope of human control. And that sort of anchors the old paganism in a way, right? Like, that's partly why you can get an Aristotle emerge out of the old paganism, writing, you know, the Politics and these other wonderful works that end up being highly simpatico with Christian philosophy. The new pagans, if we're to call them, you know, such, they do view they view certainly nature out there as malleable, something that humans can interact with, but they also view our own natures as something that are entirely malleable and subject to the whims of the expressive individual. So they do have this strong view that everything in the material world, including our own bodies, should be subject to the self-expression of the autonomous individual. And So I guess how do you that
square that circle?
Individual, you know, expressive individualism, how do you fit that within the pagan what you see as an emerging paganism?
Sure. The differences between the ancient or old paganism and the new, I think, are mostly cosmetic and mostly sort of taxonomical. They're differences in sort of rhetoric and vocabulary, but the substance is largely the same. And I'll try to explain what I mean in a succinct way. The old pagans, I think, did view natural phenomenon as something that sort of embodied the power of these divine beings. There were signs of the favor or disfavor of the divine beings, and they sort of patterned their worship and their rites around assigning to natural phenomenon divine status in many cases. But I think we also need to understand that they also believed, and this is remarkably consistent across the ancient pagan, you know, not just sort of like ancient Mesopotamia, but in other parts of the world too, understood that there were like real beings that were behind the operations of the natural world, and that, but not just real beings, but there were real powers, right, that were available to them. And if they swore fealty and offered sacrifice to these beings, then they could get secret knowledge. They could get advantage. They could get material goods. They could get advantage over their enemies. This was how, and I'm not saying you don't have to believe it, right? I'm just saying this is what they thought, right? The Jews thought this too, but much of their account in the first, 11 chapters of Genesis is a correction to the pagan account, right? So the pagans would say, Baal, the son of man, overthrew his father, El, and took the throne of the universe as the most powerful god governing the cosmos, and therefore we render worship to Baal and do what he says. The Jews corrected that and said, no, the rebellion against heaven failed. It didn't succeed. It failed, and the Most High God threw Baal, that is to say Satan, down to the earth and his angels with him. And they're here now. And these fallen angels are the deities that these pagan peoples worship. And that was the Jewish account. And that's the Christian account as well. And that's how the early Christians understood the Old Testament and the Old Testament deities that were worshiped by those pagan powers.
So Augustine understood the Roman deities too.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So this isn't, again, not my idea. So to bring that to how does that connect in a modern context? And what do we mean when we talk about new pagans or modern pagans or neo-pagans? And I would say again, that the modern materialist, the scientistic mind, the skeptic is loath to, acknowledge these gods as such, but is open to spiritual forces, what C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters called the materialist magician. This is a famous passage in which Wormwood, Screwtape's nephew, is asking whether or not it's our policy to keep ourselves hidden, right? For demons to keep themselves hidden from the humans that they're trying to ensnare. As Screwtape says, our policy for now is to remain hidden, because if we reveal ourselves, then we can no longer make skeptics and materialists out of men. And we want them to be skeptics and materialists because we want to close off belief in the enemy. And by enemy, he meant God. We want to keep them from believing in God. But, he said, we have great hope that in the future, a new kind of man can be created. We can help forge a new consciousness in man, what he calls the materialist magician, who remains closed to the belief in God through his materialism, but is open to spiritual forces, not calling them as such, but veritably worshiping them. And he said, if we can create the materialist magician, then the end of the war will be in sight. And one of the things I argue is that we can see this materialist magician coming into being now in the modern context. The idea that we are going to have a secular materialist society in which everybody disavow spiritual forces and the supernatural is clearly not happening. That is not what is happening out there right now. People are out of one side of their mouth proclaiming that they believe in the science, and out of the other side of the mouth, they are undermining science and reason and rational thought by their actions and by their choices and by their desires and their will. And so again, to trace it back to what you said, Josh, about how the ancient pagans, they saw, you know, these natural phenomena and assigned divine cause to them. And the modern person, the skeptic, assigns, you know, these rational scientific explanations to natural phenomenon. Yes, there is a disconnect there. There's a difference there. But the rational materialist mind is not a mind that is necessarily closed to the supernatural and to spiritual forces and to supra-rational or unscientific causes for things. And that's playing out. And I would say also that this new pagan person that is emerging is also willing to look to the spiritual world for answers and for powers and for abilities that are unavailable to them. Just as the ancient pagans sought secret knowledge from the gods in exchange for sacrifice and fealty, the new pagan, and I go into this in the book, and it's, you can see it in things like the way the architects of AI talk about what they're doing, or in how the transhumanists talk about what they're doing, or the life extensionists talk about what they're doing and what they believe. They believe that there are things that are available to us that are not purely rational or purely materialist, and they're reaching and grasping for those things while retaining a lot of that materialist skeptical vocabulary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and with respect to the expressive individualism that I'm mentioning, I mean, I suppose one thing you could do is also is say that where people see these deities has shifted, right? So people can, I do think the modern person is a lot more likely to see that deity located in themselves, like in contrast to the ancient pagan, like, because they think they have the power to declare themselves a man or woman. They think they have these certain powers that the material world, you know, sort of must conform to.
Look, I mean, that's not to jump in too quickly here, but that too, I think, is an expression of paganism. That, you know, the paradigm here, the claim, I guess, is that there's the only alternative to Christianity is paganism, and paganism at its root is being enthralled to the devil. Okay. Just to get right down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
And what does the devil promise in the garden? You will not surely die. You will be as gods. Isn't that the first lie? That we will be as gods, that we can be a god, and we can create ourselves, right? This is a pagan idea, right? One of the things that paganism produces is the idea of a God-man, right? And just at the moment when pagan Rome reached its zenith and proclaimed the emperor as a God-man, the man who was a god, who is God, appeared, right? And broke the whole thing apart. So the transhumanist idea, or the transgender transhumanist idea, it's really one ideology that we can create ourselves and be as gods. I do consider that to be a pagan idea, insofar as it is buying into the first lie that was told in the garden, that you will be as gods. And when you start pulling at those threads, when you start interrogating the transhumanist movement and what they say, on the one hand, yes, they're saying we are our own gods and we can create ourselves. But then they also say other things, which suggest that maybe they would like to be or are trying to be in touch with other powers. that have things that they want. And one of the people that I kind of profile in a section of the book is a Silicon Valley transhumanist named Brian Johnson. This is the guy Time Magazine profiled in September with a puff piece about his efforts to not die. This is a guy who's made hundreds of millions of dollars in Silicon Valley, and he's decided to bend his fortune on the pursuit of immortality. He believes that he can stop and reverse the aging process. And one of the things that he's really bullish on is giving over every decision that he makes about his body, about what he eats, how much he sleeps, what he does. Every decision day to day in his life is determined by these AI algorithms that he believes can confer immortality on him. Now, Brian Johnson and people who think the way he does are not going to call those AIs, you know, a god. They're not going to like wring a chicken's neck in front of a totem to the AI. But what we call that isn't as important as what we understand it to be. This man is rendering worship to what he does believe, even if he doesn't call it that, he believes this is a deity, this is a being, a powerful being that can confer on him immortality. One of the things that he was willing to do, because these connections just keep going and going, and you have to kind of get beyond the kind of like vocabulary difficulty. One of the things that this guy did early on in trying to halt his aging was to ingest the blood plasma of his 18-year-old son. Now, what does that remind you of? He thought, using his rational, scientific, materialist mind, that ingesting his 18-year-old son's blood plasma would halt or slow his own aging process. In the end, he found it didn't, and so he stopped, but he was willing to do it. That's just about as perfect an example of a modern pagan at work as I can think of. And that's what I mean when I call these people pagans. It's not that they don't believe in gods, it's that they call them something else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and no, that really makes sense. And I think, yeah, this is helpful for our understanding. You know, I'm approaching the definition of paganism from perhaps a narrow academic lens, but I mean, at a high level of generality, of course I agree. I mean, you know, we're not talking about a battle of ideas here. We are talking about the fact that there is a God who's made the world. And he has, you know, he has a rebel who's on this earth, Satan, and people are in one kingdom or the other. And, you know, I think that, you know, I think we've talked about this a bit, you know, but there's very striking satanic analogs between the transgender movement and just what we know about Satan as a character, right? I mean, if you read Paradise Lost, you know, Satan has this idea that it's better to reign on earth than to serve in heaven. You know, he talks mm-hmm. about how just his act of being, it makes himself, he every day he finds out how deeper of a hell he can make for himself to be condemned to. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you read queer theorists and all of this, they talk about perpetual revolution against what is natural, what is normal. They don't even want, you know, they're not satisfied mm-hmm. with becoming bourgeois, you know, loving families. They don't want that to be a norm. They don't want norms. The very concept of a norm right. must be perpetually revolted against. So there's this, I think that's really helpful to get on the table, that definition, because it helps to frame, I think, you know, where we continue to go here. Time in, you want to,
and the reality is too, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh no. I mean, it's just piggyback. I think it's a good point, Josh. Good illustration. I was just sort of piggybacking off of, you know, maybe one way to think of this too is, you know, it's again, as you were saying, Josh, a sort of academic approach to be like, okay, well, what's the, you know, let's analyze, the constituent parts of XYZ religion so we can sort of present a taxonomy and organize the world according to this. But if we're Christians thinking about this, there's only really two options. And you know, nothing really changes within those two options. There's different expressions, and inside of providence, things do change. But there's really no other option besides these two things. And you can sort of, so it's natural that even under the guise of different language, as you said, John, different outward practices, that at the root they're really still the same thing. And this could even be, you know, if you think about it, like, you know, some of the defining marks of ancient paganism and the way to think about the gods, like one trait would be the ability to shapeshift. And another one would be, you know, on the human side, the goal of the great warriors and heroes is, of course, some version of immortality that they can acquire through some kind of deal with the gods, and followed by works performed on earth. And both of those things are expressed in the transhumanist in the latter case, and in the former case by the transgender people, right? To sort of, so it is, as you were saying, John, just I'm thinking out loud, it is a control over nature and destiny in a sense, and not resigning yourself to any kind of higher transcendent control over those things. You're at least intricately involved, even if you are appealing to, as you said, more powerful beings that are going to aid you in that process. But it is human centric in that way. So
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, to the point about, you know, individualism and kind of the deification of the individual, I think that is that's sort of a lie that Satan and his demons, that is to say pagan deities, would like very much people to believe. But I think it's sort of a ruse and a tactic to lull, because, you know, the serious transhumanists, and this gets into AI as well, that they very quickly, you know, that shift from a kind of materialist, skeptical kind of language and vocabulary into using mythological and religious terminology. They talk openly about creating the gods. They talk openly about how AIs that don't behave are golems. They talk openly about them as these other beings that they are trying to create. And I don't think that's an accident. I think that the idea of the individual as his or her own god is a way station on the road to something else. And I think that we can see the outlines of that emerging in our own time right now, that this sort of like the idea of the purely rational materialist individual being their own sovereign is giving way, you know, to a new embrace of spiritual forces and spirituality, in which the individual, while still claiming kingship over oneself, acknowledges and seeks out aid and help from discarnate beings. Right? This kind of thing is getting very popular, and I chronicle a lot of it in the book. This comfort, this comfortableness with acknowledging the existence of other beings and seeking out their help and seeking out their power. You know, you have especially young people on TikTok, you know, this explosion of interest in witchcraft and spells, and it's easy to laugh at it. But I think, you know, once we're done laughing at it, we have to ask, why is this happening? Why would this be happening now, right? Because according to the worldview of someone like Richard Dawkins, this is the last thing that should be happening. This stuff should be over and done with by now. Well, instead, there's an explosion of it. Why? Mm. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to get at in this book and articulate, that the end of the Christian era does not bring in cold atheistic rationalism. To quote the writer Paul Kingsnorth, there's a throne at the heart of every culture, and something is going to sit on that throne. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to be able to see what it is.
Yeah, because at like bare minimum, you know, with the way AI is being used, you know, it's at bare minimum, it's like the consultation of the oracles at Delphi. Yes. Or something, right? Like at bare minimum, it's that. And then when you get into creepier stuff, like integration of these, yes, technologies into the human persons, which apparently, from what I can tell, their aspirations are at least this would happen at scale, or if not at sure. scale, at least for the elite, right, would have this. So that gets even creepier. And then, you know, if you remember, talking about like internet trends that are easy to laugh at until you kind of think about them, like the probably 6 or 8 months ago, that thing that went around where people had plugged into the, you know, AI art generators, some very mm-hmm. creepy prompts, and the results were, you know, astounding. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Twitter would even do the initial censorship of the pictures of most of them because they were so violent and strange and, you know, frankly, demonic. I mean, so we can think whatever we want. It's like, well, you know, you can trick the algorithm. It's not its fault. It's like, well, you know, maybe that's true, but this is also bizarre that we're creating things that pump this stuff out. I do think it's incumbent on Christians to think a little more spiritually about life, which is what we claim we do also. And maybe it's really the Christians that are kind of suffering from the opposite or converse process that you're saying the new pagans do, where the new pagans outwardly and in their language, it's still an appeal to the Dawkins era. But that's mm-hmm. really not their practicing. Christians on the outwardly and publicly and in their rhetoric are appealing to a spiritualized world, but are really in their action and thought more conforming mm-hmm. to the Dawkins world.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to put it. And I think that's, you know, part of my goal for the book is not to propose a 10 steps solution to save America. Spoiler alert, there's not a chapter like that in the book, but just to get people to wrap their minds, especially to get Christians to wrap their minds around what's happening and to get out of that frame of thinking and to recognize that we're in a spiritual war. It's not just a war for souls, it's a war for nations and whole societies. Mm. And we need to accept the fact that our society is post-Christian, and the long kind of truce between Christians and the Christian faith and the state and the political power is coming to an end. And if we're not going to have a polity that's based on Christian principles, we're going to have a polity that's based on pagan principles. And that means you'd better offer a pinch of incense to Caesar, even if you don't believe Caesar's a god. One of the things pagan societies needed to have was uniformity in the performance of the official state morality or the official cults. That's why they couldn't tolerate Christians, you know, dissenting. And they didn't even need the Christians to believe that Caesar was a god. The Romans didn't either, right? But they needed them to offer the pinch of incense to Caesar as a pro forma endorsement of the state regime, of the state morality. And we're seeing that emerge in our time. If we think that we can kind of trundle along as Christians and maintain opposition to same-sex marriage and opposition to transgender ideology and opposition to abortion and be left alone, man, we're living in a fantasy world. We need to wake up and realize that is not what the future is going to bring. And it's not a hopeless, you know, it's not a council of despair. But the first step is just accepting what is and what the reality is the post-Christian era is not going to end in our lifetimes. This is a generational struggle. The church isn't going to go anywhere. The faith won't be destroyed. But America? Well, America is not going to decline and fall, but it might become evil. And we need to start preparing for that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's as you said, it's not a council of despair, but I was going to say it's a great note to end on. It's not exactly great, but it is sobering and I think true. So it's a good note to end on in that regard. John, thank you so much for your time and for talking with us about this book. It's from Regnery, I think you said. It's called Pagan America. And what is it already totally available for sale? Everyone can go get it right now?
Yes, it came out the last week of March. Yes. It's available on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the discussion.
Absolutely. Well, everyone go grab a copy. And, you know, these are deep things to think about and difficult, and we probably don't want to do them. But I think, John, part of your case is we have to if we care about our country and our future. Audience, thank you, as always, too, for joining Josh and myself. As we talk to interesting guests like John, do subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss those episodes. And of course, go read the articles and other content on the website, AmericanReformer.org. Until next time, God bless.
You can find American Reformer on the internet at www.AmericanReformer.org or on X.com, formerly Twitter, at AM Reformer. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Please consider supporting us today by making a tax-deductible donation through our secure online donation portal at AmericanReformer.org. That's AmericanReformer.org.